From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Did the CIA sell tons of cocaine to the Crips and Bloods of Los Angeles, making it the crack capital of the world? Congressmember Maxine Waters calls for a full investigation. In our back-to-school series, the culture wars in the classroom over the teaching of history. And the Senate debates two laws targeted at gay and lesbian Americans.
One day when MJ was off work, the medical director bought ice cream for the entire staff. When I asked him what the occasion was, he said they were celebrating because MJ wasn't around. Then he added, "It's Gay Pride Week. She's probably off marching in a parade somewhere."
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Here are the latest events on the presidential campaign trail. President Bill Clinton has declared the cruise missile strikes against Iraq a success, saying that Saddam Hussein now, quote, knows there's a price to be paid for stepping over the line. Bob Dole is belittling Clinton's record on taxes in a series of Midwest campaign appearances, and with a new TV ad that tells Americans you shouldn't have to apologize for wanting to keep what you earn. It's your money. Ross Perot is indirectly criticizing both Dole and Clinton for their support of military force in Iraq. He says war is not a place for politicians to create a positive image and get a bump in the polls. He said this to applause from about 4,000 members of the American Legion in Salt Lake City. And former presidential campaign strategist Dick Morris has signed a book deal with Random House. The political consultant who resigned in a sex scandal last week struck a deal to tell how he engineered President Clinton's comeback and move to the right. An historic debate will take place in the Senate today over the Defense of Marriage Act, known as DOMA, a law that recognizes marriage only as a union between a man and a woman and allows states to refuse to accept gay and lesbian marriages performed in other states. The law already passed the House, and President Clinton has promised to sign it. But the road to passage will be complicated by a series of amendments that gay rights supporters in the Senate plan to introduce today. Among them is ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, a law that would prohibit discrimination against gays and lesbians in hiring and promotions. President Clinton has also said he supports ENDA. The Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest gay membership group in the country, has produced this ad with the hopes of swaying the ENDA vote.
Christine Todd Whitman said discrimination against gays has an adverse effect on productivity. Coretta Scott King supports the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Barry Goldwater said it's about protecting basic rights. Kathleen Gingrich said, "I think gays have the right to a job if they can do it." More than half of Fortune 500 companies have policies banning job discrimination against gay and lesbian people. 85% of American voters agree. Tell your senators to join President Clinton in supporting the Employment Non-Discrimination Act on September 5th.
Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll bring you highlights of the Senate debate. And later in today's program, you'll hear from ENDA supporters whose voices and experiences won't be heard on the Senate floor. And following yesterday's debate on Democracy Now! Around the U.S. bombing of Iraq, we got this letter from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group, which is based here in New York City. They wrote to us that while Daniel Pipes is concerned about the soft treatment Saddam Hussein is getting from the left, Pipes himself co-wrote the New Republic article calling for the U.S. to back Saddam's regime in the late 80s. It was called Back Iraq, It's Time for a U.S. Tilt. And they showed us a piece from their newsletter called Fair, and it says in 1987, following the Reagan administration's taking Iraq's side in the Iran-Iraq War, the New Republic published this article, co-written by Daniel Pipes, and it said, "Ironically, helping Iraq militarily may offer the best way for Washington to regain its position in Tehran. The American weapons that Iraq could make good use of include remotely scatterable and anti-personnel mines and counter-artillery radar." You're listening to Democracy Now! For the better part of a decade, a San Francisco Bay Area drug ring sold tons of cocaine to the Crips and Bloods street gangs of Los Angeles and funneled millions in drug profits to the Contras, run by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. This is according to a recent series in the San Jose Mercury News. It goes on to say that this drug network opened the first pipeline between Colombia's cocaine cartels and the black neighborhoods of Los Angeles, a city now known as the crack capital of the world. Well, as a result of this series in the Mercury News, Congressmember Maxine Waters, who represents the Los Angeles area, is calling for a full congressional investigation. And in just a few minutes, she'll be joining us from Washington. But right now, we're joined by the man who did the series on the Crips, the Bloods, the CIA, and the Contras. And he is Gary Helms. He is Gary Webb. And he joins us from California. Welcome to Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gary Webb.
Hi.
Hi. Well, why don't you begin at the beginning before we have Congressmember Maxine Waters on with us.
Sure.
Tell us how you first ran into the story and started to investigate it.
I ran into the story when I was looking into a drug case in Oakland that involved some Nicaraguans who were being held in prison. At that point, they'd been in jail for 3 years and they'd never been brought to trial. And one of their girlfriends called me and told me that, you know, I had been writing about asset forfeitures for quite a while, and she told me that there was a pretty good asset forfeiture angle to that case. And then she also mentioned that one of the witnesses that the Justice Department had brought in to testify against these folks was a Nicaraguan named Danilo Blandon, who she claimed had been connected with the CIA and had sold thousands of kilos of cocaine in Los Angeles during the last decade. And she not only told me that, I mean, she provided me with some grand jury transcripts in which he had admitted under oath that he had sold cocaine for the Contras and had given the money to the organization. So I just started checking this guy out, and eventually found out that he was not only did that, I mean, he was a former Nicaraguan government official, he had an MBA in marketing, and he was the man that was responsible for bringing cocaine in that touched off the crack epidemic in Los Angeles.
Gary Webb, I should say that we are now joined by Salim Wakil, who is my co-host from Chicago, senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times, and he has been following your series with a great deal of interest. Salim?
Good morning, Amy and Greg. Good to meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
I come in on the conversation a little late here. I don't know exactly how much you've revealed about your series, but what I want to know is how has the official how has the series been responded to? How have they received it in Washington?
Well, actually, it's been pretty amazing response. Although it's hard to tell that from like the daily press. I mean, you had within a couple of days after it came out, Barbara Boxer wrote to the CIA and asked for an investigation. Yesterday, Dianne Feinstein also wrote to Janet Reno and demanded an investigation. So you've got both California senators asking for an investigation. Maxine Waters, who represents South Central Los Angeles, issued a pretty strong letter the other day to both Reno and John Deutsch at the CIA and Henry Hyde, the head of the Judiciary Committee, asking for an investigation and asking for hearings. So, I mean, the response from Washington has been pretty good. We'll see if anybody does anything first, but so far it's been very rewarding.
Did you have any problem getting cooperation from people from the DEA and the CIA when you were doing your research?
Well, I had problems getting cooperation. I also had problems, with them. The DEA asked me not to do the story at all if I was going to mention Blandone's name, because he, you know. The thing about it is the guy that brought crack to L.A. is now working for the federal government, and he's an informant for the Drug Enforcement Administration. And the DEA felt very strongly that if I identified him publicly as a DEA informant, they were going to have problems with pending investigations. I think their concerns may have been more, they're going to have problems with the fact that the guy's on the federal payroll to begin with.
Yeah. It seems quite strange to me that all of this, this current campaign by the Republicans, especially to castigate the Clinton administration for allegedly facilitating the rise in drug use over the last few years, and there's been no counter argument from the Democrats about the Republican administration, the various Republican administrations' complicity in this devastating drug epidemic.
Yeah, it's mystified me too for a number of reasons. I mean, if you look at the statistics that everybody's citing to support this claim that there's a huge rise in young drug use, I mean it's an infinitesimal increase. I think the figure went from like 96.4% that never tried drugs to like 96.2% had never tried drugs. So I mean, number one, it's kind of a phony issue, but number two, I think the problem is that this is not an issue as our pardon. The problem is that this is an issue that I think both parties have problems with historically. These Nicaraguan drug dealers came into the United States under the Carter administration. They flourished under the Reagan and Bush administration, and one of the guys is now working for the federal government under the Clinton administration. So I think historically it's been difficult for the Democrats and the Republicans to sort of go down these CIA alleyways without knowing what's going to fall out and hit them.
Let me ask you, as you were telling your story from the beginning, talking about the woman, the girlfriend of the drug dealer who first called you and talked about the connections to the CIA, how those links were then made to the Crips and the Bloods of Los Angeles?
Well, it was, I mean, that happened as a result of purely, I think, blind luck. I had been following up a case that Blandón, he was arrested in San Diego in 1992, and ultimately to 28 months in jail, even though they were recommending a life sentence. And in talking to one of the co-defendant's attorneys in that case, she happened to mention that he was also involved in another case in San Diego where he was going to testify against a fellow named Freeway Rick Ross. And Freeway Rick, if you know anything about the drug world on the West Coast, is sort of like the Henry Ford of crack. You know, he was the guy that created the market for it in Los Angeles. And when I talked to Ross, you know, he confirmed that he had been buying his dope all these years from this Nicaraguan, but he had no idea who the guy was. He just knew he was a well-connected dope dealer. I was able to figure out that, you know, not only was he a well-connected dope dealer, he was, like, working for the CIA's army at the time that he was doing this. So the connection sort of blindsided me, actually.
And how then did it go right into
well,
the
Ross
Crips and Bloods
community? Ross was the wholesaler for the gangs in South Central, and he started dealing dope back in like the 1980-81, and by 84, according to the records that I got from the DEA, Blandón was supplying him with 100 kilos of cocaine a week, which he was then turning into rock cocaine and distributing to the gangs.
And then they would take the product further east.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think Rick Ross himself knows how far his cocaine went. I mean, he would wholesale it to people who would then take it everywhere. And what I do know is that, you know, you didn't find crack in a lot of cities. Actually, you didn't find it in any cities before it started showing up in Los Angeles. And then it started popping up all over the place in short order, not too long after Ross and Blandón made the connection.
We're talking to Gary Webb, who's author of the San Jose Mercury News series on the CIA funneling drugs into Los Angeles to the Crips and the Bloods, eventually leading Los Angeles to be the crack capital of the world. Now, what about the investigations into these drug dealers and how they were thwarted from the very highest levels of government?
Well, I don't know how high the levels of government were that thwarted these investigations. I mean, the police who did them, believed that it was the CIA that was sort of looking over this drug operation's shoulder for a number of years. What I found was that I found a number of investigations in which people either A, were say directly that the CIA was involved in either compromising the investigation or tipping off the target or leaking information to people who just said it was national security interests that were involved. I mean, I found some FBI reports from the 1986 that talked about a Customs Service investigation that was looking into this, and it was going to indict Meneses, and then Meneses was warned by a corrupt, and then the name is blanked out agent, or that, they would do these drug raids and nothing would be there when they had absolute accurate inside information on this drug organization. So it was very bizarre that this organization operated for all these years with very little police interference. And then when they got there, when nothing would be left.
For many years, black radicals and others have alleged that cocaine was being filtered and was being shipped specifically into the black community to destroy any mobilization attempt to demobilize the community. In any sense. And did you find any associated political motives in your investigation?
Well, obviously the political motive for this ring was to support the Contras. I mean, the guys that were running it were Somocistas. They had supported Somoza. Blandón himself was a former official in the Somoza government. Norman Meneses, the man who actually ran the drug ring from San Francisco, his whole family was connected with the Somozas. So, I mean, there was a political motive in that regard. As far as why they chose South Central and why they started selling it in black areas of the city, I'm not sure, and I'm not sure if anybody really knows that except Danilo Blandón. But what I do know is that the man they sent to Los Angeles to do this had an MBA in marketing, and he started marketing it to a group that had never seen cocaine. I mean, it was just too expensive at the dawn of the 80s. To be widespread in South Central. But after he went down there, the stuff was just everywhere.
Gary Webb, do you know, speaking of that, this whole process of making cocaine smokable, is that something that derives from Latin American countries, or is that a process that came about because of the enormous quantities of the drug were available?
It was a combination of the two. There was a study that was done in by NIDA, which was never published by NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse. What they found was that people had been smoking cocaine in Colombia since the 1930s, but it wasn't until recently, and I put that in terms of at the time of the study was done, that it had been seen in the United States. What had happened was there was this product in South America called Basé, which was something you got before you actually got cocaine powder. It was like a paste that had a lot of chemicals and solvents in it. People started smoking that in Lima, Peru. American drug dealers who were down there at the time saw this stuff, tried it, and were amazed by the impact it had, because when you smoke cocaine, it has a completely different impact on your body than when you snort it. They came back to the United States and tried to recreate what they had seen in South America, and according to the scientists who did the study, they looked it up in the Merck manual, which is the organic chemistry handbook, looked up the formula for cocaine base, which they thought was Basé, and then they made it from that. But the problem was, it was a completely different product. I mean, they had reverse-engineered powdered cocaine so you could smoke it, whereas in South America, they were smoking something you got before you got the powder cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And, it wasn't a very popular way to do it for a long time, simply because it was too expensive to mess around with.
Mm-hmm.
But once it started coming in from Colombia in shiploads, as the Nicaraguan ring what we explored was bringing it in as, it wasn't too long after that before it became a very popular habit, first in South Central L.A., then in the rest of the country.
We're talking to Gary Webb, author of the San Jose Mercury News series on the bringing of cocaine into this country, funneling it into Los Angeles, particularly into South Central, and who is behind it all, leading to the Central Intelligence Agency. We're going to come back to this discussion in a minute. Congressmember Maxine Waters will be joining us, talking about what she's calling for as a result of Gary's investigation. But I also want to give out the web address twice, and now and at the end of this conversation, of where you can get Gary Webb's series called The Dark Alliance if you don't live in California, and it's not easy for you to get the San Jose Mercury News. I was amazed to see all the documents on the web last night, not only the articles, but the documents that are used to back it up. And the web address is www.sjmercury.com/drugs. That's www.sjmercury.com/drugs. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Salim Wakil, my co-host in Chicago. We'll be back with Maxine Waters and Gary Webb in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil. Our guest is Gary Webb, author of the San Jose Mercury News series called The Dark Alliance, documenting the relationship between crack cocaine and cocaine in this country with the Central Intelligence Agency and its support of the Contras in the 1980s. Also joining us now by telephone from Washington, D.C., is California Congressmember Maxine Waters, who represents the Los Angeles area that Gary Webb is talking about. And we welcome you, Maxine Waters, to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Congressmember, what are you calling for right now as a result of this series?
Well, I'm calling for everything. I've written to Janet Reno asking for an investigation into the CIA. I've written to the Republican leadership of certain committees asking them to hold hearings. I've written to and will be meeting with members of the Congressional Black Caucus, suggesting that we hold our own rump hearings also. I've written to all of the federal judges who I've been in communication with previously about rock cocaine mandatory sentencing. And I'm calling for investigations, I'm calling for hearings, and I'm going to use all of my priority time on this issue, helping to support what Gary, Mr. Webb has done. And first of all, let me just thank Mr. Webb for what I think is perhaps the most significant piece of journalism that we have seen in many years, and the most documented piece of journalism on the origin of crack cocaine into inner cities, particularly South Central, and the connection to the Nicaraguans and the Contras. I think this is the kind of work that will help us to expose the kind of undermining that goes on in our communities.
Let me ask you a quick question, and that is an issue you have taken on with a vengeance in the last months, and that is the issue of how crack cocaine, people who use crack cocaine, sell crack cocaine, get a different penalty, a much harsher one, than those who use cocaine, and the racist implications of that. Well, how do you connect that to this investigation, looking at the CIA behind it all?
It's quite obvious to me. First of all, we have the documentation of how crack cocaine really started and flourished in inner cities. And now these same cities and these same communities are being targeted by the Justice Department, and these young blacks and Latinos are being given mandatory federal prison sentences for the sale of one rock cocaine or a few rock cocaine, while the big drug dealers, who obviously are still out there like Blandone, are going scot-free. And every now and then, they're setting up somebody like a Ricky Ross and feeding them up to the feds, and the feds are acting as if they are confiscating, they're busting a big drug dealer, when the big drug dealer is the one who has led them to the little drug dealer, and the big drug dealer is out on the streets going free. It is outrageous. The prisons are filling up with all of these inner city minority youth for these small cells of rock cocaine with these mandatory sentences. Their lives will be ruined forever. Once they do this 5-10 years in federal pen, they're not going to ever be able to rehabilitate themselves and get jobs, etc. But this is our government who's doing this at the same time. It was our government who put it there in the first place. It's outrageous.
Representative Waters, it seems, good morning, by the way, and I agree with you about about the impact of this piece by Gary. It's absolutely stunning, the research that he put into it and the way he presented it. It seems to me that it is stunning enough to give the Democrats some ammunition to counteract the charges that the Republicans are throwing around about their complicity in the drug, the increase in the drug use. Why, Representative Waters, do you think the Democrats are refraining from using this argument?
Well, first of all, I don't know that Democrats are refraining as much as I don't think that they're paying attention to this information that has been unveiled by Mr. Webb. What we see each day is one or two Democrats coming online to join in with requesting that Janet Reno do an investigation. We've got several now that I know about, and we have some inquiries that are being made. The more Gary publicizes this, the more we help him publicize this, the more I think the inquiries will be made and the more it will catch on. This morning, by the way, I've got to leave you and go to a hearing that is being held in the Banking Committee under the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations about money laundering and Mexico. And what I'm going to do is introduce into that discussion this morning this Gary Webb series and charge and challenge the Republicans who are now in charge of all of our committees, that this is what they should be investigating. As a matter of fact, when there was some attempts to investigate not only the Nicaraguan connection and the Contra connection to the drugs in South Central and our cities, there was some limited discussion about money laundering, all of which got swept under the rug. You know, a lid was put on it. All kind of obstacles were put in the way. And so this morning, I'm going to use this opportunity of this hearing to introduce the Gary Webb articles. I will have them on the desk of every member in that committee, and will challenge them to do the investigations on the drug dealing that went on then and still may be going on.
Congressmember Waters, has John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, joined you in this? Now, he, in the 1980s, was doing the most serious investigation of what was going on, the bringing up of drugs into this country to fund weapons to the Contras to kill Nicaraguans in Nicaragua under the Sandinista government. But he was thwarted every step of the way in his efforts and threatened by the federal government, et cetera, the CIA. Has he expressed interest in working with you on this?
Not at this point, and I think it's just a matter of days when a number of members will catch up with these articles. What I'm finding is many members still don't know about them. We have been fortunate, you know, on the West Coast with my office has been bombarded with letters from people in the Bay Area who read the articles first, and we've gotten the information from Gary Webb, and they've been very, very helpful in making sure that we have all the information, we have all the details, and as it spreads, I expect more and more people will be joining in this discussion.
Now, your colleague, California Senator Barbara Boxer, has also called on CIA Director John Deutsch to do an internal investigation of the relationship between the drug pipeline and the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yes, she has, and I think now, as of yesterday or so, Dianne Feinstein has done something in requesting an investigation. I think as the days go on, we're going to see more people, but I think it's going to be slow. I think they will send the letters, but in terms of whether or not we're going to actually get the hearings and whether or not this is really going to be at the forefront of this discussion on drugs is only going to be caused because we got to drive it. We got to drive this every day. We've got to do something. I will be on the floor of Congress tonight, I believe, for an hour with the articles and doing the discussion. That's going to get a lot more attention. I will continue to do that.
So people can tune into C-SPAN to hear you do that, right?
Yes. I will be on the floor sometime this evening for about an hour in that time that's allotted for kind of these free, willing discussions where I will unveil it, and then more people will pick it up. So I think more people will get involved as we keep driving this discussion.
Gary Webb, is there any connection, did you find any connection in your investigation to the MENA, Arkansas airport that was rumored to be an entry point for drugs in the 80s?
The connection that was that, you know, there were two of these pipelines these Contra cocaine pipelines that were operating in the 1980s, they were sort of parallel operations, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. The East Coast operation was the one that involved MENA. That's the operation that John Kerry's committee went into in the mid-80s, and I thought fairly thoroughly exposed. I mean, when I got a hold of that Kerry committee report, I was astonished and actually a little embarrassed to be a newspaper reporter, knowing that this information had been public record for all these years, and had nobody had done anything with except sort of dismiss as the work of kooks and conspiracy theorists. MENA happened. I mean, they were flying drugs in and out of that little airport. They were flying arms in and out of that little airport. The guy that was running that operation, a guy named Barry Seal, was a CIA informant. He was a DEA informant. You know, it had all the earmarks of this operation out here. And you know,
while this was under Reagan and Bush's reign, right now the Republicans are going after Bill Clinton and saying, since he was governor at the time and knew about this, they're calling on John Deutsch, the CIA director, to investigate.
It is sort of that MENA thing has sort of gotten an interesting second life lately, because the Kerry committee pretty thoroughly exposed that operation. I mean, they tracked it all the way to Oliver and Barry Seals, all the way to Oliver North, and it was curiously quiet after that. But lately now, since somebody realized that, well, you know, we got a Democrat that was in charge of the state at that time, which I agree, I think is a very interesting situation. And I think MENA ought to be explored, and the CIA Inspector General is already doing an inquiry on that. You know, it's part and parcel of the same operation, essentially.
Well, I think the interesting thing about all of this is Dole has decided to make drugs a part of the presidential debate. You know, he's been searching for an issue. The president came out with being opposed to children using tobacco, and Dole has come back with, you know, there's been this great, as he calls it, great increase in the use of drugs by teenagers, which is fueling a debate. They have came back in just a political way to try and find something to hit Clinton with. I think this is an opportune time for us to keep forcing into this debate the information that's been unveiled by Gary, which is going to bring up all of that other information about MENA and the Texas Air Force Base, where the drugs were being brought into from Colombia, according to the series that Gary has done.
Congressmember Waters, what is Henry Hyde as head of the Senate, as head of the House Judiciary Committee's committee? What is his response to your call for investigation?
He has not responded to me. I will see him today at some point in time. I'm going to try and have a personal conversation with him about it. I'm going to ask him to hold hearings. And again, nothing is going to happen until it heats up.
What does that mean in terms of listeners right now who are interested in this information getting out?
The listeners must demand the hearings. They must join with us and demand the hearings and let the axe fall wherever it falls. Democrat, Republican, doesn't make any difference. The people of this country must be outraged that their government was involved, is involved in drug sales, putting drugs into cities that have caused crime and violence and death and tremendous health problems, drug addiction. I mean, everybody's got to be outraged by that. We can't afford to learn what we are learning and to have it focused for us by a journalist who's put tremendous time and effort into it and not respond and not, you know, for some answers.
Well, Congressmember Waters, we do have to wrap up, but I just want to give out some phone numbers if people want to get a hold of the series. If you do surf the net, if you are on the World Wide Web, once again, Gary Webb's articles, his series called Dark Alliance, and all the updates when a senator or congressmember calls for an investigation, etc., they're doing this day by day. They're up there. The World Wide Web address is www.sjmercury.com/drugs. That's www.sjmercury.com/drugs. And Gary Webb, if people are not that comfortable on the web or don't have access to it, how can they call for reprints of your series?
Thank you, and I must leave you guys now.
Thank you very much, bye-bye. Congressmember Maxine Waters of California.
We did a reprint. They can get it by calling 408-920-5999 and asking for one.
One more time?
408-920-5999.
408-920-5999.
1-800-799-9999.
I'm sure there are going to be a number of calls for this series, and an excellent one at that. It is called The Dark Alliance. Gary Webb, thank you for doing the series and for continuing to investigate the drug pipeline into this country.
Well, thanks for taking an interest in the story.
Well, it certainly was one that we could not put down. And Salim Wakil, thank you for joining us from Chicago. Again, senior editor at In These Times, columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. And now we're going to move on from the story about drugs to the Senate floor and what won't be happening today. The latest word from the Senate is that the Defense of Marriage Act will not be debated or voted on the floor today. Instead, it's been postponed until next week in a fight over what amendments can be introduced. The Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, says that the federal government refuses to recognize same-sex marriages and allows states to do the same. While the White House has acknowledged that bigotry and divisiveness are driving this law, President Clinton has pledged to sign it. The gay and lesbian community has reacted with outrage, fearing that gay voters might not show up in force for Clinton this November. The White House has decided to support a strategy to tag a pro-gay law onto this anti-gay law. The pro-gay law is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, known as ENDA, which would bar job discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. At a Capitol Hill news conference yesterday, sponsored by Senators Ted Kennedy, Jim Jeffords of Vermont, and Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, ENDA supporters gave testimony on the importance of passing this law. Among them was Nan Miguel, whose story shows how ENDA benefits gay and straight workers alike.
My name is Nan Miguel, and I'm here to talk today about from firsthand experience about why the Employment Non-Discrimination Act is absolutely necessary. Like most people, I assumed that the law protected everybody from job discrimination based on sexual orientation. Unfortunately, this is not true, and I had to learn this the hard way. All I did was stand up to harassment and discrimination aimed at a young woman in my workplace, and for that, I was forced out of a job that I did very well. I used to be a manager of the radiology department at a small hospital in Pullman, Washington, just across the border from my home in Moscow, Idaho. When I was first hired, we were extremely understaffed to the point that I often handled all of the ultrasound, all the mammograms, all the paperwork, and even slept in the hospital overnight to handle emergency room cases. Eventually, we were able to increase the number of staff members to accommodate the workload. And in 1993, I had an opportunity to expand my ultrasound department by hiring another technologist. Among the applicants was a bright young woman whom I will call MJ. She had all the right credentials and the kind of experience we needed. The medical director, a physician with staff privileges at our hospital, checked her medical references and found them to be good. So I asked her in for an interview, which went very well. Almost immediately after MJ left, the other technologists began snickering about her. They joked about how obvious it was that this woman was gay, something they apparently based on the way she dressed and looked. Soon after, the medical director came to me for a private chat. He told me that some of the technologists thought MJ was gay, and he didn't think I should hire her. I told him it was nobody's business whether she was gay or not. As a manager, I think it's wrong to decide whether to hire or fire someone based on something like that. Workers and job applicants should be judged on their qualifications and their performance. So I hired MJ because she was the best person for the job. Soon thereafter, the medical director started to complain that the ultrasound department was, quote, overstaffed. He also never gave MJ a break. He made it clear he was irritated with her by her very presence, and even though she did her job very, very well. He was rude to her in front of other people, and I'm talking patients and employees alike. He refused to review her cases or even to write her an evaluation performance so that she could understand what he wanted of her. MJ did her very best to treat him the way she wanted to be treated herself. She asked me what she could do. I suggested that she give him more space, always be polite, and give precise patient histories whenever he asked. She did all that and more. But it didn't make a difference. One day when MJ was off work, the medical director bought ice cream for the entire staff. When I asked him what the occasion was, he said they were celebrating because MJ wasn't around. Then he added, "It's Gay Pride Week. She's probably off marching in a parade somewhere." I wrote a letter to the hospital administration describing the medical director's behavior. His harassment and abuse was disrupting the workplace, and I was afraid it would jeopardize patient care. To my amazement, the administration took the doctor's side. and suggested he was merely responding to the level of discord in the department, discord that he was creating. I was placed on a 3-month administrative leave. MJ's hours were reduced. She filed a grievance merely seeking to return to full-time status. Instead, she was fired. 4 days after Christmas in 1994, I also was fired. And you know what? I still don't know whether MJ is gay or not. I've never asked her. It doesn't matter to me. She did her job and just wanted to live her life in peace. And she deserves no less than that. There is no documentation of wrongdoing on my part anywhere in my personnel file. It is clear to me that I lost my job just because I refused to join in the discrimination aimed at a member of my staff. Since this terrible experience, MJ has moved to another state and tried to put her life back together. I have moved on in my career. But it's clear to me that if there had been a law like the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, this story would have a different ending. No one should have to endure what MJ endured. And no fellow worker should ever be fired for standing up to discrimination. Thank you so much for your time.
Nan Miguel speaking yesterday at a Capitol Hill news conference sponsored by Senators Kennedy, Jeffords, and Lieberman. She was calling for support of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, known as ENDA. And again, the latest word from the Senate is that the Defense of Marriage Act will not be debated or voted on the floor today. Instead, it's been postponed until next week, and a fight over what amendments can be introduced will continue. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, our special series on education, because, yes, it is back to school. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Goodman, and this week on Democracy Now! We've been bringing you a special series on public education called Carefully Taught: Clashing Values in the Classroom. One of the most critical battlegrounds in the culture wars is over the teaching of history. While progressive educators have tried to introduce a diversity of perspectives into history lessons, conservative critics have been attacking these new curricula as politically correct. Barbara Bernstein reports.
The lens through which we view history is a reflection of how we perceive the present. And the struggle over whose history and how history should be taught has become one of the defining battles of the culture wars in the classroom.
Over the last several years, there have been attempts made to try and rewrite history.
Mel Kleben is a school board member in Lancaster, California.
There have been political correctness that have tended to take over some of our historical understanding of how various groups within the United States have been treated over the last 200 years.
We're not going to learn about traditional American heroes. We're going to learn about obscure people.
Conservative homeschooling activist Kathy Duffy.
Because we want to be truly multicultural, and so we're missing some major pieces of information here to effectively fulfill a political agenda. And that in itself is a value statement.
When you go into the past, you uncover not just questions about facts, but questions about values.
Howard Zinn is a historian and author of The People's History of the United States.
By looking at history, you should be compelled to examine the values that lead you to a certain view of history and to re-examine the values that lead you to look at certain things today in a certain way. During the quincentennial of Columbus in 1992, for the first time, teachers around the country are beginning to teach the Columbus story in a different way. Bill Bigelow, a teacher out on the West Coast, went around the country in 1992 talking to teachers about how the the Columbus story should be taught.
Well, let me give you an example about how I start my U.S. history class every year. I start off by stealing a student's purse.
Bill Bigelow teaches history at Franklin High School in Portland, Oregon.
And I'll say, well, this is my purse. And the students say, no, that's not your purse, that's Nikki's purse. I say, no, it is my purse, and I'll prove it to you. And so I open the purse, and I'll take out her comb, and I'll say, well, this is my comb. And I'll take out some lipstick, and I'll say, well, this is my lipstick. And they'll say, no, that's Nikki's lipstick. I'll say, no, it's mine. I say, well, if you don't think it's mine, then prove it to me. And they'll say, well, we saw you take it. Well, let's say I discovered the purse. Then does that make it mine? And they say, no, just because you call it something different doesn't, it's still, you stole it. I say, well, how is this any different from what Columbus did? I mean, Columbus came, and there were people living here. They had stuff in their land. And yet we say Columbus discovered America. Well, what else could we call it besides discovery? Well, Columbus ripped off. Columbus stole America. He invaded it. He conquered it. And kids can see very quickly that naming is political, that naming takes sides, and that language takes sides. And so what appeared as just a neutral term before, Columbus discovered America, who could argue with that, that kids see that we need to begin to ask some questions about the way in which history is taught and whose side history instruction takes.
One of the first historians to deconstruct the myth of Columbus was Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States.
You can say, I'm tearing down Columbus. But why? I'm tearing him down because I'm telling people who read my book what is true and what is acknowledged even by the admiring biographers of Columbus, and that is Columbus was a murderer. Columbus killed Indians. Columbus enslaved Indians. Columbus tortured Indians. He cut off their arms. The gold motivated him.
Christopher Columbus was a brave man, and he was the equivalent of the astronaut of his time. And as far as those people in Europe knew, they didn't know what lay beyond the horizon.
Kevin Wright Carney is a board member for the Antelope Valley Union High School District in Southern California.
The fact that Native Americans happened to be at the other end was not Christopher Columbus's fault, and in fact, European culture was spread to America. North and South America wouldn't be what they are today without European culture.
Do you want me to make him a hero? Because he's a good navigator?
Howard Zinn.
Because he's a good sailor? No, he's not a hero. The heroes were the people who resisted him. The heroes were the Arawaks, who fought with no weapons against these Spaniards who had horses and wild dogs and muskets and lances, and who slaughtered them. Those are the heroes.
To say that Native Americans were slaughtered by Christopher Columbus's crew is absolutely false. And show the documentation that they were killed.
Where is the documentation for this?
Bill Bigelow of Portland Public Schools.
The documentation is his own journals, his letters, the Spanish priest Bartolome de las Casas, from contemporaneous accounts of people who were with Columbus. Columbus kidnapped about 31 people on his first voyage, and if you read his journal, and they're widely available, they're not hidden off somewhere, Columbus himself writes, "Let us, in the name of the Holy Trinity, go on sending all the slaves that can be sold."
We haven't had a revolution in American education, but there has been just enough change to move the right wing into hysterics about it.
Howard Zinn, author of The People's History of the United States.
All you have to do is begin to change the picture, and they get hysterical, and they see, my God, the whole educational system is being taken over by Marxists. Why? Because we're starting to tell a different story about Columbus? Because we're starting to talk more about the women in American history, or give more attention to black people, or to talk more about how the Native Americans had their land taken and their tribes annihilated?
Arguing over Columbus is just the first of a long series of battles, as every step of American history is open to reinterpretation. At the center of these debates is, how do we define what is American culture and history? Do we only honor the voices and views of people of Western European ancestry, or should we make space for all voices and viewpoints to be heard? But no matter what side of the debate you take, it becomes obvious that the way we teach history will always be value-laden. Steve Baldwin is the chair of the California State Assembly Education Committee.
We should be proud of our own culture, proud of our own system, proud of the great achievements of Western civilization, and proud to state that some of the ideas of Western civilization may be far superior to some of the ideas of other cultures. And I don't think we should be ashamed to make that statement.
I disagree that there's any civilization better than any other. The mixing of all these different cultures that came here that makes America what it is.
Lily Lopez is a parent activist and community school board member in Brooklyn, New York. She was a supporter of the controversial Children of the Rainbow curriculum, attacked vehemently by the religious right in 1993.
Multicultural education is, I think, the only way for children to really survive and prosper. We need to learn how to respect each other and not attack each other just because someone has a different colored skin or speaks a different language or lives at a different economical level than you.
I want to make sure that all the voices are heard.
Karen Miller is a middle school history teacher in Portland, Oregon.
So we do a lot of writing where they write about their lives, they write about the people in their lives, their perspectives. And then as we're studying various people in history, people that have worked for change, I have them step out of their shoes and write from someone else's perspective. And a lot of times when they learn about people in history who have worked for change and people who have been successful, they get excited and they're ready to look out the window and figure out what needs to be changed, and they're ready to do it.
I want my students to have certain values, but I'm not going to tell them this is the value you should have.
Howard Zinn.
But I think that if I bring to the attention of my students aspects of black history that they didn't know about, if I confront them with the reality of lynching and the way that it existed, and if I have them read the autobiographies of black people and what they went through, just getting that perspective from how black people look at their own lives and look at the world about them is something that helps change their values towards a greater understanding of what it means to be a black person.
By omission, I was taught that everything of value that was ever done in our country was done by white men.
Sharon Kerr teaches fifth grade in Oakland, California. Her own grade school experiences during the 60s were very different from the way she approaches teaching now.
We were in suburban Los Angeles. The Watts riots were going on probably 20 miles from our home. And do you know, I have no recollection of ever discussing this in school. Of course we should talk about, why is this going on? What are these people rioting about? What is the anger about? In an amazing sort of repeat of history, very shortly after I began teaching, the Rodney King verdict came down, and Los Angeles started rioting again, and Oakland had some uprising here. And it was a wonderful opportunity. It was a wonderful chance to talk to, these are 9, 10, 11-year-old people who are dead now. You know, what's the point of learning about history if we're not going to apply it to our lives right now?
For Democracy Now!, this is Barbara Bernstein reporting.
I learned your dates and numbers. I learned that you were the winner, that you were civilized, and I was your burden. School days, I learned about your victories, the valor and the glory that was yours, and I, the heathen, had to hide, 'cause God was on your side. You never told me the thief came in the night and stole my birthright. You never told me the empire you built then was founded on the bodies of my murdered brethren. through your eyes. Now I clearly see the lies you call your history school days. You taught me with your movies the red man was no man at all. He could not hold his alcohol. Black man likes to sing and dance, but does not have intelligence. Why do you need lies to make you feel man-sized? Why do you need lies to make you feel man-sized? School days. You said my sins would be forgiven if truly I repented, he'd wash my sins away. Your way. But you have not repented. You are just the same. You never told me that Jesus was a Jew. And still you swear his hair was fair, his eyes were baby blue. School days, you taught me to despise, missing through your eyes. But now I clearly see the lies you call your history, the lies you call your history. Why do you need lies to make you feel man-sized? Why do you need lies to make you feel man-sized?
Lobby Siffre singing School Days here on Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. You're calling the Pacifica Archives, and you can call to purchase a tape of today's program or any other program. And again, that number is 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to call our comment line or write to us, let me give out some of the addresses and numbers. Our comment line is 1-202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. And our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And by the way, for those listeners who've been calling and writing and asking Democracy Now!, will it continue beyond the November elections as a daily political talk show? Yes, we are going to continue. And we are also looking to hire a new producer, a hardworking person with political savvy and preferably significant radio experience. If you're interested or know anyone who might be, send a letter and a resume to Julie Drizzen at Democracy Now! Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. That's Julie Drizzen, Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. And of course, you can send any letters to that address. And we're going to start reading those letters on the air and playing some of the comments we get on our comment line.